Hello and welcome to Literary Loitering, the Geek Show show all about all things literary and a little bit of loitering.
Yes, hello. How's everyone doing?
Good.
A little bit of loitering, did you say that?
A little bit of loitering, yes. There won't be any connectors here.
So we've got that all out of our system now.
Yes, we got it all out of our system. We won't explain that one. If you want to know what that's about, listen to On The Box.
Yes.
Right.
Good okay. Plug there. Good plug.
Anyway, moving on. We've got news. The Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, one of the biggest prizes in, you know, literature, has gone to a novel called All The Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. It's an imaginative and intricate novel of the Second World War. Now, the Pulitzer Prize is worth $10,000 or £6,700, and it is the single biggest fiction prize in America. You know, and a lot of British authors would like to have the Pulitzer Prize on their shelf as well, because if you've got that and, say, the Man Booker Prize, you've basically made it as an author.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got those two, you can basically go to any country in the world and go, yeah, I'm winner of Man Booker and the Pulitzer. They go, oh, right, welcome. Would you like to stay in our best hotel?
Plus, actually, if you were to do that, like, at the airport, you would just, like, shove it under your coat, walk through the metal detector and go, oh, no, that must be my Pulitzer Prize that I just keep with me at all times.
The thing is, the Pulitzer is specific to Americans, unfortunately. It's distinguished fiction by an American author, preferably dealing with American life, but not necessarily. It's been won in the past by the likes of Harper Lee, William Faulkner, and Alice Walker. Doerr's novel, which has already been a finalist in America's National Book Awards, and which was chosen as one of Amazon's books of the year, it beat titles by former winner Richard Ford, Laila Lalami, and Joyce Carol Oates, who has been shortlisted 3 times previously. It's a pretty impressive achievement to win something like this. It's a very, very impressive achievement to win something like this. So hats off to Anthony Doerr. Well done. Congratulations on winning.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, when the book eventually comes out in the UK, we'll feature it on the show. Well, we'd be very interested in. Moving on, have you guys heard of a kink app?
I hadn't until like a few minutes before the show.
Yes. The kink app is a social erotica app whose aim is to get people taking turns. You know when you were in school and they gave you a piece of paper that was folded up into just so you could just write one sentence on it? And they passed it around and they got each person to write a sentence where they couldn't read what was written before. And then at the end you had to read it all out and it just was complete gibberish.
Like, it's kind of like Chinese, well, not so much like Chinese whispers, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. Basically, the Kink app is an app for that, but for erotic fiction. And the plan is to have people take turns on collaborative stories in multiple sizes, from micro to epic, and then share them with the wider world. The pitch is basically, we want to create a social based 50 Shades of Grey. That's the pitch. I don't buy it.
No. I won't be buying it.
Well done. Touché. Everyone's so fascinated with the success of 50 Shades of Grey, and I don't understand it.
Why does it have so much money?
We're not going to answer that. We're not answering that. There is an answer, but we're not featuring it in this show.
I mean, I don't understand how it's been such a runaway success. I mean, the French said it best. I'm sorry, but the entire country of France, hats off to them. You know, and my hat is off today.
Well, if there's one country that knows about erotic fiction.
Well, not just that. I mean, the line from France was basically, why do we need to read 50 Shades of Grey? We had the Marquis de Sade.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It sums it up, doesn't it?
It really does.
The inventor of BDSM is, was French. Why the hell do they need 50 Shades of Grey?
If anything, they would have been better to write 50 Shades of Grey.
No, because
I don't think you need skill to.
No, well, depends.
Have you read the book? Thankfully,
thankfully, no one at the show has.
Well, unfortunately, I have had to read part of it.
Oh, I am sorry to hear that.
For the purposes of review, I had to read part of 50 Shades of Grey. It didn't go well. It didn't go well at all.
I can imagine.
It just made me angry. You know, if I could Hulk out, I would have. but no. Yeah.
Yeah.
You wouldn't like Hulk when he's had to read written Twilight fan fiction.
No, Hulk would use it for other purposes. Lighting fires, you know, if he ran out of toilet paper. These sorts of things.
All the smart ways to use that
yes,
book.
The smart ways.
The smart ways, you know. Well, actually, I'm the not sure about know. The toilet paper one. You might be afraid to put it anywhere.
Oh, no. Can we move on?
Yes, moving on. Right. Moving on to one of the main stories, and this is an ongoing story that we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. Puppygate. The Hugo Award fiasco, scandal, whatever you want to call it. It's been called right wing, it's been called left wing, it's been called no wings, it's been called always. I don't really understand what's going on anymore, but amidst this storm of controversy, the nominees have decided to withdraw, which I think is the biggest shame.
It is.
You know, two authors have withdrawn their work from contention for the Hugo Award, which is like one of the awards for science fiction, in the work, and this is in the wake of George R. R. Martin calling Puppygate, calling it Puppygate and saying it's a right wing plot. Marco Clues, whose novel Lines of Departure had been picked up along with four other authors for the best novel Hugo, which an award right winners of the Hugo Award include Dune and Neuromancer.
Yeah, some like
two of the most iconic, two of the most iconic science fiction novels of all time. He announced on Wednesday that he'd withdrawn his acceptance of the nomination. Annie Bellet, whose Goodnight Stars was a contender for Best Short Story, has also withdrawn. Both writers had been included on a slate of titles pulled together by a group of right-leaning science fiction writers, dubbing themselves the Sad Puppies, who had mobilized fans to pay for membership of Worldcon, enabling them to vote and thus flood the categories with their choices.
That is something like this. It's about the skill they have, the imagination, and they can write good stories. And people just
See, I've done some reading into this, and originally when we brought this story, I thought Sad Puppies maybe had a point, you know. But after reading into this a lot more, I can't but help but agree with George R. R. Martin about this. Brad Torgerson, the author behind Sad Puppies, wanted to reverse what he called the Hugo's favouring of works that were niche, academic, overtly to the left in ideology and flavour, and ultimately lacking in what might best be called visceral, gut-level, swashbuckling fun. Now, on the level of being an entertaining read, I can understand that, but when you start adding in, you know, leaning too far to the left, when you start adding politics, ideologies or political leanings into it, then, I'm sorry, your argument ceases to be relevant.
Your argument is invalid, essentially.
A lot of it, though, I mean, it does come down to the same thing, though, doesn't it? It's like, with any award as well, it's smart. I mean, we discussed this last week. It's, instead of just choosing the best of what is available there, you've got the same genre and things being represented over and over again. You've got even cultural views taken again and again.
Yeah.
It's wrong, really.
Yeah, it is. But I can't help but agree with George R. R. Martin, I think when it comes to the point of nominees withdrawing their nomination because they don't feel comfortable...
That's definitely gone too far.
Yeah.
You know, they don't feel comfortable about their work being judged in that kind of forum. It's disrespectful to... the whole point of the point of that award.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it's also disrespectful to these authors because they can't then have the confidence that their work is there because they have talent.
I mean, just out of principle, I'm not going to read Sad Puppies. I mean, it's a shame because it seemed like it sounded like a good book, but if I'm all
Sad
about
Puppies ain't a book, it's a movement.
Oh, no, okay, fair. I'm not. Either way,
but you're not going to read that movement.
No, yes. No. Wait, what was the book called again that was submitted that started this whole?
It wasn't one book. It was all of them.
Oh, really?
Oh, the original nominations, not the shortlist, basically said that of all of the original nominations. Were, you know, basically they weren't fit for purpose, and they basically convinced people to join Worldcon so they could vote and have their own nominations put forward.
Well, I'm all about people having egos. Yeah, ego, that's fine, but if you take that's just taking it too far, and you think, it mustn't be because they don't like me, but it must be some kind of conspiracy. No, they didn't think it was as good as the other person's. Just accept that.
Yeah, I mean, if you remember last week, we talked about the kind of opposite, the other side of Sad Puppies, which is Rabid Puppies, who are led by the writer Theodore Beale, who is known online as the Voxtear. He's an inflammatory far-right blogger who was expelled from the Science Fiction Writers of America following racist comments about the award-winning author N.K. Jemisin.
He's an author I'm going to avoid.
Yeah. This is what Clues wrote, who withdrew his nomination. It has come to my attention that Lines of Departure was one of the nomination suggestions in Voxtear's Rabid Puppies campaign. I cannot in good conscience accept an award nomination that I feel I may not have earned solely with the quality of the that I may not have earned solely with the quality of the nominated work. I also wish to disassociate myself from the originator of the Rabid Puppies campaign. To put it bluntly, if this nomination gives even the appearance that Voxtear or anyone else had a hand in giving it to me because of my perceived political leanings, I don't want it. I want to be nominated for awards because of the work, not because of right or wrong politics. I agree. Mm.
Yeah, that's how it should be.
I applaud him. I applaud his stance on that. But I think it's shameful that that people are having to withdraw their nominations.
It is. I mean, they've basically just ruined what's supposed to be a fantastic, you know, showing of works, and they've just ruined it.
Yeah. And Bellet said she was withdrawing because this has become about something very different than great science fiction. I find my story, and by extension myself, stuck in a game of political dodgeball where I'm both a conscripted player and also a ball. My fiction is my message, not someone else's, and I refuse to participate in a war I didn't start. Again, totally understandable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We're going to watch that. Watch how that unfolds. I think it is a real shame that they've had to withdraw their nominations. But as I said, if they can't have confidence that they've been nominated based on the quality of their work, then, you know.
Yeah, I think it's definitely understandable why they've withdrawn them.
I want to see more authors taking the stance that George R. R. Martin has and start a counter movement, but
when you've got a right wing nut job like this guy calling himself Voxtear, I mean, how pretentious is that? When you've got someone like Theodore Beale, was it? I can't remember his name. I've forgotten already.
Don't care about his name.
That's why I forgot his name. Yeah, I don't care about him. He, someone like that, you just want to punch. Seriously,
again and again and again.
I mean, his comment about N.K. Jemisin, basically saying that N.K. Jemisin wasn't as intelligent as a white person.
That was so out of line.
Yeah, you know, because genetically, her race was different from white people. I thought we lived in a much more enlightened period.
I think on the whole thing you do, like, but there are just some people.
Thing is, that's the kind of thing I'd expect from somebody who's been living in a cave for the past 1,000 years.
Yeah. The majority of us are more enlightened, but we're not part of the sub species that this guy is made of when he made these comments. As far as I'm concerned, he's the less intelligent one.
Yes, he's subpar, is he?
Yeah, he can't even be counted as human.
I think that's one of the worst things you can say to somebody. Yeah. You know, you can say, as a human, you're subpar.
Yeah.
It conjures all sorts of deliciously nasty comments.
There's people such as him that, it's not too nasty.
Yes, no way. Theodore Beale, you are subpar as a human being.
He can't even count it as a human being.
Yes.
Organism.
Yes.
That's too modest.
I'm not going to say anything about, you know, monobrowed, knuckle-dragging, buck-toothed, chinless wonders.
Okay, good, because that is an insult to monobrowed, knuckle-dragging, chinless wonders.
We could insult them all day, but we've got to keep moving.
Yeah, we've got to keep moving. Moving on to the Bible.
segue. Wait. I've never heard of this Bible.
Right. Does Cleveland have like a state book? Is it like Viz or something like that?
I really thought you were talking about Cleveland Brown there. I thought you were talking about Cleveland Brown there.
No, no. Our county of Cleveland.
Yes.
Right. Does it have a county book? Like a book that, you know, because over in the States they have this weird thing called a state book, and it's a book that apparently represents your state. Right. Mm.
Yeah.
Tennessee wanted to make the Bible their state book.
Which, to be fair, what book better represents Tennessee?
Yeah. There was a plan to make the Bible the official state book in Tennessee, which was derailed on Thursday when the Republican-controlled state Senate sent the measure back to a committee, effectively killing it this year. The bill has divided Republicans in conservative Tennessee. Some say the Bible is far too sacred to be deemed an official state book. Conversely, others believe it's an integral part of the state's history, because apparently the Bible was written there.
Oh, of course, yeah.
No, it wasn't. We're just making that
up.
Are you sure? I think remember, I died for your sins, y'all.
We went from one part talking about subhumans and we're back to subhumans again.
Yeah. Tennessee's Attorney General Herbert Slattery warned in a legal opinion earlier this week that the bill would violate separation of church and state provisions of both the federal and state constitutions. Similar worries about proposals in Mississippi and Louisiana caused lawmakers there to drop measures in recent years. Still, the GOP-controlled Tennessee House of Representatives approved the bill 55-38 on Wednesday. Senate Majority Leader Mark Norris, one of the state's most powerful legislators, said Thursday the constitutional concerns were the main reason for sending the bill back to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which could take up the bill next year.
Okay, I just say, Americans are really good at starting conflicts in other countries. It's about time they started one in their own country.
Well, this isn't really a conflict.
Well, I don't know.
Didn't they have that whole Civil War thing that one time?
That one time, yeah. Well, actually,
over a 2% tax increase.
Yeah.
That was it, 2%. That was what sent them over the edge, a 2% tax increase. Yes. And they basically went, oh, William Wallace. and then, gave Mel Gibson a reason to make that awful movie called The Patriot.
I would kind of justify that film, but I don't want to.
There is no justifying that.
That's why I don't want to do it.
There's a question there with this, though. What if you're, like, of a different religion?
Yeah, Andrew said it best. Don't live in Tennessee.
Exactly. They don't care about any other religion.
And what if another state wanted the Bible?
Do you know what I find hilarious about places like Tennessee and other places in the Bible Belt? They believe in faith healing, but they think if you're healed with, you know, if an old woman heals you using herbs and, you know, and common sense, it must be witchcraft. but they believe in faith healing.
To be fair, they
believe a man can put his hand into your body and withdraw the bullet. Using some kind of weird religious
using Jesus
magic.
Kinesis.
To be fair, I'm still surprised that the Bible Belt has electricity. That's still
No. The Bible Belt has electricity. Yep. They actually want electricity. Yeah, you know, because how else are they going to get rid of all the criminals and unwanted people?
That's a fair point.
You know, their version of burning witches has a different meaning.
I'm surprised they don't have like lightning rods scattered all around it. Oh, we don't generate electricity. We take it from God.
No, no, they do have lightning rods. They tie the witches to them.
That's right, they do. Yes. Yes, yes. The anyway, Bible Belt about 200 years behind the rest of America, which is about 100 years behind us.
Yes. Anyway, there's a very racist theme to the news today.
Yeah, but it's mainly Americans.
No, no, this is actually UK.
Oh, that's true.
There's a... black and Asian authors in the UK say they're being shoehorned by a publishing industry which is almost blindingly white into writing fiction that conforms to a stereotypical view of their communities. Prime example of this was J.K. Rowling with the Casual Vacancy and the way her description of was it a Pakistani woman or an Indian woman or a Sikh woman, something like that. Interviewed as part of a major new piece of research into diversity in publishing, the award-winning novelist Bernardine Evaristo was scathing in her indictment of the British books world. 3 decades ago, a few novels were published by Britain's Black and Asian novelists, while 20 years ago, a breakthrough occurred that became a short-lived trend, said the author of Blonde Roots, a novel that flips history to put whites in the roles of slaves. But for the past few years, we have seen a return to the literary invisibility of the past, concealed by a deceptive tokenism. Children's laureate Mallory Blackman agreed. Over the last 3 or 4 years, I seem to have gone back to being the sole face of colour at literary or publishing events. What happened?
That's a good question. What has happened?
I'm not sure. I honestly, I'm not sure how this has come about, because there are some amazing authors from ethnic minorities. I think this is symptomatic of a wider trend. I think this is just one of those tips of the iceberg kind of things. What the world we live in right now, we have the likes of Nigel Farage running around going, "Oh, fear the immigrants, fear the immigrants."
Yeah.
Problem is, he doesn't clarify which immigrants you're supposed to be scared of. Mm. So what you end up with is a state where people are afraid of people of color rather than what Nigel Farage is actually talking about, because he's talking about European immigration and everybody is white. So, yeah.
To be fair, I think even that confounds Nigel Farage. Like, they're white and yet they're not us, so why do I hate them? But I do.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. He can't... when you look at it, when you have somebody of colour as opposed to somebody who's white, then maybe from a different country... Say you have an Italian and somebody who's come here from Italy within like the last six weeks, right? And somebody who has parents from, say, Bangladesh, and was basically born and raised here and educated here, right? And generally what you'll find is the Italian person won't have any kind of commentary made about them.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the Asian person will.
I mean, it's not just that. I mean, it's also what it's about what you're saying. Yes, but so it's also about more. I mean, like the Eastern Europeans, like the Polish and Romanians, they'll say a lot about that. But like Italian, French,
no, I mean, the thing is, they don't actually say a lot about the Polish anymore because it's cascaded down. It's gone back to being. Mm. It's gone back to. The old form of racism that was around during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where if you are visibly different from white, then you will be a target. And you have Nigel Farage, with this false message of, message about immigration, causing people to fear people who look different. Mm. And this is one of the effects of that. The fact that the publishing world is now looking at it and actually, subconsciously being scared of ethnic minority authors.
And just slipping back into these old habits.
I mean, we took one big step forward within the last 10, 20, maybe 30 years. Now we're taking 2 steps back. And it's just...
But you have to, see the point disgraceful. It shouldn't be looked upon like that. It should just be looked upon. Or if it just so... like,
is the work any good? It doesn't matter who wrote it. Is the work any good? Does it make sense?
That's all that should matter.
Is it a good story? I mean,
Fortunately, I think that's just in an ideal world.
Mm. I mean, the last thing you want is Asian writers, or writers of ethnic minority, given they're working, but changing their name so it sounds more white.
Well, here's the thing, right? This should prove just how backwards this country is when it comes to racism, right? Everyone celebrated when America got a black president, yeah?
Yeah.
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 But has there ever been an inkling of an Asian or a black or an Oriental prime minister?
No.
Not to my knowledge, no. Think of anyone of colour who's like high up in the government, really.
Well, no, aside from Keith Vaz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keith Vaz is the only one. Oh, and Chukka as well. Chukka's another one. I can't remember his surname, but they're pretty much the only two that I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the question is, are ethnic minorities not interested in getting into politics? Because I know a lot who are.
Yeah.
You know, or just, is it? Or are there stumbling blocks to ethnic minorities getting into politics?
It is a big problem. I mean, the government can say, this government can say, they are giving everyone in the UK consideration. But, you know, when you look at something like Prime Minister's Question Times, or like when you look at the problems in the House of Commons, it's just a sea of white.
Yep.
And it's not... The point of the government is supposed to be a genuine representation of the British people, but it's not.
The thing is, though, as well, when you look at that, you always get the same class as well.
Oh,
well, it's because they're all like Harrow and Eton boys, aren't they?
I think, isn't Nigel Farage the only person that isn't... Well,
I'm sorry, but when your dad is a millionaire stockbroker, you don't count.
That's a good point. That is a really good
working
point.
Working class underdog.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
mean, he goes to pubs and has a pint. Oh, yeah, you're so working class, you stockbroker, son of a millionaire stockbroker. Nah. Silver spoon in your mouth, stockbroker. Stockbroker is not a normal job.
No.
It's not a job that you would find, say, a working class person from the north of England doing.
No. Nope. It's usually someone from the south.
They wouldn't really work as a stockbroker.
No.
Yeah. Pizza delivery.
Yes.
I'd love to see. If Nigel Farage's roots were, say, you know, market gardener, pizza delivery, shelf stacker at the local supermarket. Yeah.
Yeah.
If he'd gone from that to being a politician, I'd have more respect for him.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. It's like something where you could go, I've been delivering pizza so I can deliver these policies to you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or something like that, you know?
Look at you with your spin words with your spin words and phrases.
Took me ages to pick up.
Yeah, to be fair, Nigel Farage would probably say, I couldn't get a job as a pizza delivery because immigrants had taken that as well.
Who was the Labour spin doctor who was called the Lord of Darkness?
Wasn't that Alistair Darling?
Mandelson.
Was it Mandelson?
I think Andy's gunning for his job.
Is it the Lord of Darkness? I wouldn't say the Undertaker.
No. Isn't that Ozzy Osbourne? Well, that's the Prince of Darkness.
No, I'm just putting a majority Osbourne running for Prime
Ozzy Osbourne and Peter Mandelson just plotting. And then just the Undertaker walks in.
No, because you've got all the Monty Burns jokes with Peter Mandelson, you know.
Yes.
All the Monty Burns ones where he's just tapping his fingers together, going excellent.
Yeah. Hugh Dennis did it brilliantly on Mock the Week when he had to say what they're saying, and he's like, just been thrown around some facility. He's going, the machine. When will it be ready? To make him sound so evil. Hugh Dennis did it the best.
I think there is a problem, but I think it's a much deeper rooted problem than we think. Right, moving on. The Times top 100 most influential figures. Who do you think's on this list?
Oh, is it just like
Nigel Farage?
even the Times gives him just because we talked about him a lot, and I do think he was quite influential, Terry Pratchett.
Well, unfortunately, he's passed away.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But they've added an unusual name. Haruki Murakami is now one of the Times 100 most influential figures. And if you've read any of his work, you'll actually understand why.
Okay.
He's written some amazing, amazing books. It's not often you get an author of his caliber being recognized in such a way, but this guy is multi award winning, and Japanese author. this is kind of knocks what we've just been talking about in the previous article a little bit, but not so much that I think is still a problem. But Haruki Murakami is one of those authors who, because he made his name somewhere else and made his fame somewhere else, when it came to British publishing of British transitioning of his work, they can't really go against the flow.
No,
he's too big a name already. But if you're an author who's trying to make a name here in the UK,
yeah, it's going to be a lot more
difficult.
It's
an uphill battle.
Mm.
You know, it's like Hollywood and Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
You know, Jackie Chan was already a massive star before Hollywood came beckoning, and they couldn't go against the flow because originally they tried to put major star with Jackie Chan, Owen Wilson with Jackie Chan,
Chris Tucker with Jackie
see what
Chan.
I did, see what I did there?
Yes.
Yeah, I went major star, Owen Wilson.
And well, let's not forget Chris Tucker as well.
Chris Tucker was in there.
Try to say Chris Tucker isn't a major star, but what about his amazing turn in that film he did?
I can only remember him in the films he did with Jackie Chan. I can't even remember those names.
But Chris Tucker, he will never ever be anything other than Ruby Rod.
Oh, in the fifth. That's what else he did.
Yeah. Put Steve Coogan
with
Jackie
legacy.
Chan.
Sorry?
Put Steve Coogan with Jackie Chan.
Oh,
well, yeah, well, Nate, you do.
Yeah, but Steve Coogan's not an A-list actor, is
no,
he?
No,
he should be, though.
The thing is, his dramatic work is actually pretty good.
He's a good character actor. Mm. Well, Alan Partridge, what was it, Saxondale? Well, I suppose... I'll just leave him there.
No, he's got some good characters under his belt, but I wouldn't say he was a good character actor.
No.
He's got the potential to develop into a good character actor.
Yeah.
And given his drama work, he's not been too bad. But, I think he needs to do more dramatic stuff rather than comedic stuff. But, yeah. I don't know how we got onto Jackie Chan, but we did.
they're trying to make it somewhere so they could make it big in their country, but then... When they come to that, they have to stick with the flow.
It was more of a rhetorical question.
But I understand what you mean. They can't just take someone's words, right, we're going to change the way you do it. We have to keep the way they're doing because that's how they make the success.
I am actually glad that they've recognised Murakami in this way. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Right. One last bit. We've mentioned this before. You know how they always do surveys and questionnaires and surveys and all sorts of stuff like that?
Surveys about the surveys, about the questionnaires, about the surveys.
Yes. There's been a new survey about the career path of author, of being an author. Now, it's apparently the dream of many a frustrated office worker. Quit the rat race and start a new life as a writer. Wrong is the dream of many a teenage school student.
So now are they trying to say now, well, everyone wants to be an author.
Everyone's always wanted to be an author.
Apparently so, yeah.
Everyone during their years at school, how many people said, oh, yeah, when I grow up, I'm going to be a writer because I've thought of this amazing story that nobody else has ever
written.
Because
it is my idea.
Written.
It is an amazing idea and has never been done before.
It's never been done before.
And the world will flock to it and need to know what I've said.
Yes, they will worship me. I will be like a god to them.
I think there was something before, though, where a lot of people at school, like kids at school, think that it's an easy job and...
It involves no heavy lifting, and all you have to do is write words
and have a good imagination.
It's the hardest thing. I think it's one of the hardest thing to make a living out of.
Apparently, most authors make less than minimum wage.
Yeah,
I saw that.
That's the report. Mm. Most authors make less than minimum wage, and when you look at it, you're like,
that's because you can hear about the likes of. Roald Dahl, J.K. Rowling, Terry Pratchett, E.L. James, George R. R. Martin. They're the ones that people think about. They don't actually think about the sort of low ones. I mean, you've got the Clive Cussons as well.
The big thing is the figures are actually quite shocking. This was research commissioned by the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society, and they found that the top 5% of writers earned close to half of all the income received by professional authors in 2013.
That is ridiculous. Wow. I mean, we keep
so all of the money earned by, say, 100 authors, you know, almost half of it went to only five of them.
It's about as bad as when we talk about...
well, crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about... We keep talking about things like the 1% of earners having 40% of the wealth, but that it still translates into
as bad
the,
as the 1% having 40%.
But you get but it's still close to it.
The thing is, writing is making a name, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you could be that name and write a subpar book.
Yeah.
I'm using that word because subpar seems to be used a lot lately.
Casual vacancy.
But it's like if you are a big name and you just release a book. For example, the casual vacancy. Yeah. People are going to read it. They're going to buy it. It's going to help out the sales. And then you're going to say, oh, that's bad, that. Shut it away.
Yes.
It'll still sell. But that's terrible thing.
Millions of... Even are you self-published very loosely as well? But you've got smaller published offers, reputation, and you've also got very few self-published that could be extremely good. And they're not getting... Nobody gives them a look over because...
Yeah, because they don't have the marketing behind them.
I don't remember much marketing for Harry Potter either, though. I don't remember why that even became a success.
Yeah, I always just remember it as being a success.
Yeah.
Like, you read Harry Potter because it was so successful that everyone was saying how good it was.
Exactly, but I don't even remember why it happened. But
Are we not sure that J.K. Rowling isn't just actually a wizard? And
what, does she have a money tree?
Probably.
It's met with magic wands and it just becomes successful.
I think Rob sees him all as a witch rather than a wizard.
I like witches.
He just doesn't want to give J.K. Rowling any consideration in his life.
No, I don't care about her enough. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
The de-extinction of the woolly mammoth.
Yes.
Right. The Science of De-Extinction is it's a new book that talks about, that basically asks the question, should we de-extinct the woolly mammoth?
Yes, because woolly mammoths are cool.
Yes.
Yeah, but the thing
you don't know that.
The climate has changed. I mean, a woolly mammoth, it evolved to deal with...
Oh, yeah, as a serious point, no, it would die so quickly.
Yeah, I don't think it could even survive in the Arctic Circle, could it?
It could probably survive in the Arctic Circle, or in Siberia, where apparently the weather is so cold, you throw hot water in the air, it freezes.
Yeah,
but still stays hot, so if it hits you, you get burned, so don't let
hot.
It hit you.
Yeah, it's just like hot ice coming off. No, that was...
Hot ice? Yeah, because they tried to do that in America
during finish
during
that
blizzard,
point.
Didn't they?
Don't finish the point I nearly said.
I was going to say, hot ice is just water, isn't it?
Yes.
And just when it gets too hot water, and it just steam.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
But yes, the extinction of woolly mammoths.
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, that wasn't a dramatic pause.
I think the answer is no, too should we.
No, don't say it, because I'm looking forward to taking my kids to Jurassic Park.
No.
Yes.
Why would you take your children to Jurassic Park?
Because it's what they do in the films.
Yes, and then the dinosaurs escape and kill nearly everyone.
That's not going
to
happen. We've learned our lesson.
It's stated, though, to eat with great difficulty. So it seems more of a hypothetical book than a...
Yeah, but... They thought the same thing about proving the Higgs boson, and look what happened. They proved it.
Yeah, he got ridiculed a lot for that, didn't he?
But they've also found dinosaur eggs, and that's not going to be...
Well, it's a start.
Right, I'm going to end the news section with one very important question, right? If a library that cost £188 million to make is available, right?
Right.
Should it be closed on a Sunday?
I'm still struggling to think how a library would cost that much to even...
What has that money gone on?
Basically, Birmingham Library, Birmingham's new library, cost £188 million.
Right.
Public money was spent on it. The question everyone's asking is, why the hell is it closed on a Sunday?
That's a good question.
Well, considering this. Yeah.
Since it's for the public.
Yeah. I mean, even supermarkets, they don't completely close on a Sunday. They're open to the point then they close. But why is a library? No, it should be open. I'm sure people will be happy to work on a Sunday for extra money.
I always thought libraries were open on Sundays.
So did I. Apparently not Birmingham Library.
I think they're closed that too much.
Birmingham
often.
Library must be trying to join the Bible Belt in America.
That's with that level of sanity.
Yes, it is, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
No, because that was always the thing. Because it was a... because it was a religious thing, everything closed on a Sunday. But it hasn't been like that for a while.
I got you.
It's a library, right? Yeah. There's volunteers that will gladly work in a library on a Sunday.
There are Asian and ethnic minority volunteers who would gladly work on a Sunday.
I'll work in a library on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So
what exactly is in this library? Does it say?
It's a library.
I do think it has books.
Books must be made.
Maybe
of gold,
some graphic novels. There may even be some manga in there. it might be like the Blockbuster. You know, the public funded Blockbuster Video as well. They may have DVDs in there as well, Andy. We're not sure.
Maybe audio books
narrated by Stephen Fry will be in there as well.
Well, I think I just have two words to us. Field trip. Let's go have a look. No, because for that kind of money, I expect the Doctor Who Library Planet.
If you want to go on a field trip to Birmingham, you're more than welcome. Let us know how it goes. I am not risking that goddamn Spaghetti Junction again.
Oh, well, I have to go to Birmingham for a year again anyway, so that'll be fun. But yeah, for that kind of money, I would expect the Library Planet from Doctor Who.
Yeah. Okay, right. We have a book review from the lovely Andrew.
Oh, we do.
Yes, we're going to make you do it. What are we talking about this week, Andy?
Today we're talking about Ghosts of Manhattan by George Mann. And it is a book that I enjoyed, despite it trying very hard to make me hate it. Okay, so shall I start with the blurb?
Yes, start with the blurb.
1926, New York City. It's the wrong 20s, but not as history remembers it. Coal-powered cars line the streets, while zeppelins and biplanes patrol the skies. The US is locked in a bitter cold war with a British empire that still covers half the globe, and the lost generation is drinking away the nightmares of the trenches. In Manhattan, a run-down police force is losing the fight against a tide of powerful mobsters, and against one in particular, the Roman. His henchmen, not all of them human, stalk the streets, and the body count is rising. It's the time in need of a hero, it's the time in need of the ghost. It's the time in need of the ghost, because it's all in caps.
Oh, right, okay. So, who is this ghost? Sorry, you were going to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm pretty sure that the British Empire only covered a quarter of the globe, so already I have a problem with that book.
Yeah, but to be fair, this is like alternate history, so I assume the British Empire is bigger.
Yeah,
we became more imperialist in the 20s, did we?
Yeah, in that timeline, yeah.
You can say what you want in alternate history, can't you?
Okay, so I think pretty much my first problem you can pretty much tell from the blurb in that, like, so it's steampunk alternate history plus, like, a superhero drama and a noir crime thriller and some sort of magic occult thing. And it's just so trying to be so many things all at once that it all just kind of smushes together and doesn't work at all.
Why do you like it again?
Well, I like it because it's a fun book. Mm. It goes through at a really fast pace, and there's plenty of action scenes that are like really well written. Tense.
So it's a bit like a 1920s.
Yeah, it is basically a 20s pulp novel.
Yeah, a 20s pulp novel, kind of like a 1920s detective steampunk Die Hard, or Lethal Weapon, or movies of that ilk.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Except also with a hero who like blows up moss golems and then flies away on his magic rocket boots.
So it's an 80s action movie dressed up as a 1920s detective novel.
Yes.
That actually does sound good now. You put it like that, that sounds good.
You'd think so, but no, technically it's a really, really bad book. Like, I can't stress this enough, that no matter how much I enjoyed it, this is a badly written book.
Are we putting this on the level of, like, holiday reading? So it's
I would put it on exactly holiday reading level.
Okay, so it's going to have an audience, we know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what's the writing style like? How is it written? Is it first person or third person?
Third person in possibly the most overly pretentious and melodramatic way I've ever read.
I think you have to read that line.
Oh, yes. Can I read the line?
Yes, yes, you can read the line.
Oh, everyone get ready for this. This.
Around the campfire.
Perhaps it would be enough to still the maelstrom in the center of his being.
I want to put that on a t-shirt now.
We'll have a lot of these t-shirts, you know.
Yeah, I know, but they'll be good.
Yes, when we finally make them.
No, no, don't worry. They'll be made.
The anyway. Day will come.
Anyway.
But yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
Holiday
anyway.
Reading.
Oh, yes, exactly, holiday reading. It's the kind of thing you can breeze through it in just like probably a few days of solid reading. And so it's enjoyable. I mean, I'll happily read the second one in the series.
I mean, thing is, would it work better? Does it work better as a book, or would it work better in kind of a visual format?
I think it would work a lot better as like a TV series.
Yeah.
Or maybe even a comic book, because it wants to be a comic book.
So it's a novel that actually wants to be a comic book. Unusual.
Yeah.
Actually, to be fair, saying that, if you want to read the comic book version of this, let you read any Batman comic. Because the Ghost is Batman.
Like, okay.
Not even in a, yes, this is quite heavily inspired by Batman, in a, no, they have literally taken things from, just Batman has said.
So were his parents murdered in front of him?
Honestly, they don't go into that, but I can only assume so.
In an alleyway on their way home from the theatre.
Like, that is my, because he doesn't actually really bother to give him much of an origin story.
Really?
So do we actually know who the Ghost is, or is it just some
random character? Yeah, you know who he is.
Oh, right. So it's like Billy Zane in that, what was it?
The Phantom.
The Phantom, yes. It's like Billy Zane in that. You're like, Billy Zane, I don't buy you as a superhero. I'm sorry, it just doesn't work.
No, but it's literally his motivation is something like, yes, the war was bad, and now I want to protect the city because why not?
Was it Stephen Baldwin? Alec Baldwin?
Oh, yes, Alec Baldwin as the Shadow.
The Shadow, yes. Yeah, that was the other one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, no, I don't. You just don't work, sorry.
No, he really doesn't.
Stephen Baldwin was the one that was on British Celebrity Big Brother. Just
when?
He was in it with a couple of years ago, I think it was with
I remember Jermaine Jackson was
that was quite a while ago now. This was a good few years afterwards.
That's the last thing I know about Big Brother was that Jermaine Jackson was on it.
I think when it was on Channel 5 it was Stephen Baldwin was in it. I'd have preferred Alec Baldwin, that would have been hilarious to see.
I don't know anything about this.
No, not clearly.
Are you sure you didn't dream it?
No, this was this is actually genuine. Stephen Baldwin was in British Celebrity Big Brother. He had some weird friendship with Alex Reed and was going to be like his mentor and agent or something. He really tried to make Alex Reed believe he could act.
Sure, Stephen Baldwin didn't just get very lost on the way home.
Yeah.
It did seem...
He stopped at the Big Brother house to ask for directions.
He did seem like he was...
got roped in.
He seemed like he was on a number
of
drugs.
Which way is Heathrow? Hi, you're on, Big Brother. Welcome to the house.
I'm going to have to show you this after, but it actually looked... He did seem like he was on a lot of drugs as well.
He probably was. Probably. It is Stephen Baldwin. But... I just got this mental image now of the Baldwin brothers looking for Stephen, just wandering around Hollywood, going Stephen, here, boy.
Yeah, I don't think Alec Baldwin actually is that close to Stephen anyway.
What about William?
I never know.
Anyway, wasn't there like a fourth Baldwin brother?
No one remembers. I was surprised when I found out there was a third one. Then we're like, oh, fourth. What?
Mysterious lost Baldwin.
Like there's a whole family of them.
Yeah. Sorry, but there's a book or a documentary in that. The lost Baldwin.
The fourth Baldwin.
there's at least a mockumentary in that.
Yes.
Oh. I don't think blockbuster conspiracy thriller.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, the new Clive Cussler novel. The Lost Baldwin. All right, okay. Yeah, we're pretty much at the end of the show, but we've got a very quick thing from Andy who's been dying to do this for a while.
This is the new Alan Sugar novel, the biography of, it's basically his time at the show.
Yeah.
And he's of The Apprentice, and he's basically asked Twitter to tweet his new ideas for the title of this book.
Yeah, that's not so, that's never a good thing to do, Mr. Lord Sugar. Don't ask Twitter to suggest titles for your new.
All you have to do is send him the hashtag Lord Sugar Book.
Yeah.
Which you've got, like, you can't polish a turd, but you can roll it in sugar.
What else, Scott?
I am what I am, Strad.
Oh, yes.
Oh, come on, don't just read it and start laughing. Tell us. We want to laugh too.
Hang on. Oh. Face like a baffled lion. The best use for a doorstop is on there. Comedy Central has posted a few as well.
Go on.
Banter in the boardroom.
Sorry, what was that?
Banter in the boardroom. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. on the other end of the finger. Back later to Carl.
On the what was that last one?
On the
other end of the finger.
How to fire people I haven't actually hired yet. Impossible to pick up once you've put down. I think it's quite.
That's quite good.
Adventures of a Rich Sugar Daddy.
I've actually
Sugar Mountain from Grain to Rain.
I've actually thought of one. Reading material for while you're on the job.
Oh.
So basically, toilet reading.
Yes,
yes. Or more simply, one of them says, "Given to the inevitable, just 99 pence."
I like it.
Yes.
Oh. Why do people do that, though?
It's the
you think someone who is as business savvy as Lord Sugar is supposed to be.
I just I just like the idea that he's actually doing it just for kicks. If he actually said, "Oh no, I did it," you know,
he's probably got a title worked out. He's just doing this as kind of a publicity stunt.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's got a book coming out, doesn't you know?
Yeah,
so, yeah. You've got
one last one. Basically, it goes along the same lines as straight pimping with Big Al from baby daddy to sugar daddy.
All right, okay. We are unfortunately at the end of the show on that note. I have been Rob.
I've been Owen.
I've been Andy.
And I've been Andrew.
Yes, join us again next week. We will have the second novel in the Ghost series. Andrew is going to be talking about that next week. Owen might also have the novelisation of Alien Resurrection.
Yes, by a female science fiction writer. That's a callback from a few episodes ago.
Yes, yes, yes. We'll see you all next week. We have been Literary Loitering, and we'll say toodle pip.
Goodbye.
Toodle pip.